Movers, shakers, makers. What makes creative people tick, and how do they find and develop their inspiration? Welcome to the podcast that draws back the curtain on the inventive mind and its artistic process. I'm Emma Lister. Monique Jonas began dancing with the Chance to Dance program before going on to train at the Arts Ed Pupil School and Rombert School of Dance. She is the founder of Jonah Dance Company, and as a standalone choreographer, she is also one of three artists given the huge platform of Matthew Bourne's New Adventures with their new dance film project, Adventures in Film. Still only in her mid-20s, she is also an in-demand dancer herself. Working with New Adventures, of course, Rombert Dance Company, Kim Branstrup, and the Richard Alston Dance Company. In fact, as our interview began, we were talking about a poster she's on for Richard Alston's final tour as a company. In it, she's wearing this honey gold-colored silk dress, and she's midair, captured at the perfect moment, the height of suspension. Shot from the back, you see her face mostly in profile, but she has this beautiful, serene look that conceals the effort of the jump. She looks like she's exactly where she should be, doing exactly what she should be doing. It's a beautiful shot, and I think actually it's really powerful because it's just one person. Yeah, it's great. So go. It's like if we take that moment in your life, you know, going on the poster of this really well-renowned dance company. If I take you way back, if we throw it way back to when you began dancing, I'm really interested in people's how they discovered their art form or their calling or whatever. And for some people, it starts out as a casual hobby. And for some people, they have this like moment of realization when they walk into a theater or hear a certain instrument begin to play. Was there someone in your life who was in the arts? Like, how did you find dance?
You see, I always say that I feel like I fell into dance. There's no one in my family that's in the performing arts, in the creative industries. In my immediate family, I'm the only kind of performer creative at the moment in my family, both here in the UK and my family in Jamaica as well. It was my primary school. It was the Chance to Dance program run by the Royal Opera House. And I was in my primary school and we thought we were doing like a PE class, you know, hopping and skipping around the room, having a great time. But I didn't realize that the people who were delivering this workshop, because it was an external group of people, were kind of having a look to see if they felt like any of the young kids had some potential that they would then invite to an audition for the Chance to Dance program. And so the Chance to Dance program essentially goes to different boroughs where classical ballet might not be typically available or readily available to the kids there. And they kind of offer free weekly classes according to your borough. And then we get the opportunity to perform at the Royal Opera House, actually, which is really amazing. I didn't realize how big it was until after when I grew up. And I was like, oh, my gosh, the Royal Opera House. And I got, thanks to Christine Woodward as well, in particular, she was a great mentor of mine throughout the Chance to Dance scheme and also my training. And I started getting weekly ballet classes and it just was great. You know, I was hopping and skipping. We used to have these red leotards and white socks and white shoes and you know, we got to perform. So that was how I was introduced to it. I think had Chance to Dance not come in to my primary school at that time, I don't think I would have got into dance in the way that I have.
It's amazing how, and dancers can relate to this, you can see it in like a five-year-old who has never done a dance step in their life. You can see it. It's quite incredible. So from there, you were taking classes kind of more recreationally, and then at a certain point, you must have decided to pursue it more seriously because you did your secondary education at Arts Ed Pupil School in London.
Yeah, so I think, again, I have to give a lot of credit to the guidance that I received and the support that I got from Chance to Dance again and the teachers that I had. Once we got to the point where we were transitioning from primary school to secondary school, they kind of, for people who they saw were really interested in it and thought that perhaps they could continue with this so that if they once they finished the Chance to Dance program, that wasn't the last time that they danced, if that makes sense. They then started to introduce us to some vocational schools, again, schools that I would have had no idea existed. And they helped me prepare a solo for the audition and stuff. And I really just was I'm enjoying it. My teachers say that maybe I should give it a go. And I said, there's no harm in doing it. I remember kind of having that type of mentality. It was just I think that would be fun. So I auditioned, I was told it's quite hard to get in at that time. It was a very rigorous auditioning process. And it is a private school. And so then there was the question of fees as well, and how are we going to get around that as a as another barrier also. And I auditioned, and then I auditioned in my borough for a scholarship to go to Arts Ed. And I was very fortunate to have received the scholarship, which was what then enabled me to go to Arts Ed for, I think it was 7 years in total. Wow, year 7 to 13. Very long time.
And while you were there, you were principally concentrating on musical theater and jazz, and I presume that you would have been dipping your toe into other dance forms as well while you were there. But you decided to round off your training at Rombert School, and that I would say is going to be predominantly putting out some of the best contemporary dancers in Britain. Was it was it a conscious choice to switch to contemporary dance?
Do you know what I think? Arts Ed, one thing I'm really grateful to at Arts Ed is that we were able to, there was quite a strong musical theatre course. Not musical theatre course. There was an acting course and a dancing course, and both sides got access to musical theatre as well. So we all did kind of singing, choir, musical shows. And I just think as I went through the years, I was just very focused on my jazz training, my tap training, my ballet, and we also got introduced to like modern, so ISTD modern, and then also contemporary. Natalie Barham as well in particular was one of our key contemporary teachers, and also the head of dance there. And so she started to take us to see shows and see performances. And it was actually with Natalie that we went to Sadler's Wells and we watched Alvin Ailey. And that was the first time I saw black technical dancers on a main stage, because up until that point, I didn't think that we were able to do it, just because my body wasn't as like flexible or open, the turnout and stuff, or how I considered it back then. So I was like, oh, maybe, I'm just not built that way. And I didn't see any role models at that time as well that looked like me doing that type of work. So seeing Alvin Ailey I was like, oh, it is possible, you know? And I made a decision to just keep training. And as Natalie and the team, the dance team at Arts Ed, continue to introduce us to more contemporary work. So I found out about Akram Khan and then also New Adventures. And I also, funnily enough, studied Richard Alston as well. And I just started to, it's crazy because I studied all of these people who I'm now currently working for. And it's a very wild thing sometimes in my head. I'm like, wow, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And one really quickly thing about it is I actually was going to stop dancing at 18 and go to do academics. And, I had my place at Edinburgh Uni. I was going to study English Lit and History. And I was like, I was doing my A-levels. I was all set to get my grades. And then I was like, I'm going to audition for a couple of vocational schools. I don't think I'm going to get in, but I'm going to audition. And I auditioned for Rombert School and The Place and also Erdang, such a variety of schools, actually. London Studio Centre. And Rombert was the one that I was like, I really like this school. And I went to the audition and I was so surprised at how classical the people were in my audition. And I was like, I'm not that dancer. Like, I'm not, my arabesque is not there. My ponche is not there. And so I said to myself, if I get into Rombert School, it's going to be a miracle. So if I get in, I should take it because someone believed in me. And that's what happened. And so that's actually how I went to Rombert, because I didn't think I was going to get in. So when I auditioned and did get a place, I was like, oh, maybe I should try this journey out a little bit more seriously.
I'd like to talk a bit about your journey to becoming a choreographer, because I think when we're younger, we see potential careers as that of a dancer or an actor or a singer, in the arts. And I think a child is less likely to say they want to be a kind of a maker, a 6-year-old. Well, maybe some do, but I certainly didn't. They don't say like, I want to be a choreographer. I want to be a playwright. I want to be a songwriter or something.
Yeah.
You tend to look up towards the people who are on stage.
Yes.
So they seem to be, the making profession seem to be more the decisions of like a young adult or maybe a grown up.
Yeah.
So for you, Was it like a decision to become a choreographer because you wanted to, you weren't finding the kind of work that you wanted to put on your body, or was it like always a calling for you? Were you always drawn towards it?
Yes and no, in terms of was I always drawn to it. I think at Arts Ed, as part of our dance GCSE and dance A-level, there was naturally a choreographic element. So I was kind of introduced to, you know, the choreographic devices and like dynamics and motifs and all of this type of stuff. And then while I was at Rombert School, we had the student choreographic showcase. And I think even to this day, I enjoy choreographing, but I've never really called myself a choreographer. Even now, I don't really call myself a choreographer either. I think I've always created when I felt like I had something to say. Mm-hmm. So even though at Rombert School, we had the student showcase, I think it was twice a year, once in the autumn, once in the spring, summer. Yeah. And I didn't create every single season. I think I created maybe two or three across my 3 years. And I only created when I felt like I had something to say, because then I felt that I would invest properly in what I was creating. Mm-hmm. And I felt like my physical language would be more authentic to what I'm feeling and what I'm experiencing with the others in the room. Mm-hmm. And working professionally, I choreographed a lot less. I was focusing more on dancing and performing and growing that side of my artistry. And I think within the past 2.5 years, being completely honest, I started to experience a lot of racial microaggressions on various different projects. And I think it opened up something in me that once that was open, it's such raw emotion and raw experiences that once that had happened and I'd experienced that, there was almost no going back. So I started to view the industry I was in, the work that I was performing in, and the different sets and people around me in a very different lens. And I got to a point last year where I just felt like I had something to say again. And so I started creating, and I made a piece called Token at Resolution, which started off as a solo in which I performed in a gallery space. And from then on, I've just kind of been developing what that artistic voice is. And so I'm not pushing myself to create something if I feel like I don't have something to say. But recently I've had a fair bit to say. So I've been making.
Well, you must have had something to say, because you've also started a company called Jonah Dance.
I have.
Quite a young age. And I have to say, just listening to things you're saying, about creation coming when you feel you have something to say, and it wanting to be authentic, and as you get older, it seems being more and more confident in that voice. And I'm going to marry that with, unlike many choreographers who start a company, yours is framed as more of a collective than as a platform for your own work. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but I have to say, the other artists I know who've said similar words and have similar sentiments are all women.
Really?
Do you think there's some a female trait to wanting things to be more of a collective, something more communal, collaborative?
I'm not too sure. You know, I think that's the first time, because I didn't realize that it was perhaps more inclined to those who identify as women to be pushing that type of narrative with the work that they're creating. And nor do I think it was particularly intentional. I wouldn't say that was the driving force. I think what was driving me with Jonah Dance is that I understand that it's some, I don't know, this sounds a bit cliche, but I do understand that it's bigger than me. Having been the only Black female in predominantly white spaces, actually, on stage for pretty much 95% of my career so far, I've noticed that when there are other Black and brown, especially young women in the audience who have seen me perform, their feedback, they're usually the ones to come back after the performance and say, thank you, it's so nice to see someone who looks like me on stage. So I acknowledge the underrepresentation on main platforms. And Jonah Dance is not on main platforms, but it's on an accessible platform, which is via YouTube and Instagram. And also we have our website, so it's online. So those who are hopefully able to access online content can start to see some representation within the contemporary dance world. And so I think It comes across as more of a collective. I've decided to do things more on a project-based thing to allow me that space artistically to feel that I don't have that pressure to create all the time. Because there are some times when it's like, you know, I'm actually not feeling creative right now. And I don't want to push myself to kind of just exhaust something to create for the sake of creating, when I can then lead out and lend the platform to someone else who might be feeling particularly creative and then can present a different voice. And so therefore that depth and variety of work within the contemporary dance, whilst also hopefully, you know, showing positive representation within the contemporary dance field as well, can come through. So it's really interesting, because I never actually put a gender to it, almost.
But that's amazing that you are able to give that same power of representation that you felt when Ailey Company came to Sadler's Wells, that you have been able to give that to some other young dancers.
Yeah, I hope so.
I did notice that much of your work is in, I almost said film, but like nothing's actually on film now.
I know.
On video.
Yeah.
Much of your work is a moving image.
You know,
it's a video, it's on YouTube. Was that a conscious choice that has just given you actually a leg up, considering the pandemic has shut down live performances?
Right.
Or is that something that you're aiming to do even pre-pandemic?
Yeah, I am quite passionate about making contemporary dance accessible. I think not too many people...
Right.
Of ethnic backgrounds in certain areas. Well, I mean, again, yeah. I could be generalizing massively, but from my experience, my lived experience, knowledge of the contemporary dance world and industry outside of its close-knit bubble is quite limited. People are very exposed to hip hop, and now so people doing hip hop theatre are doing a wonderful work of merging some contemporary styles within the hip hop style. And now we're seeing a lot more exposure with classical ballet, but there's still, in my opinion, quite a gap for that information and the representation of contemporary dance that's not So You Think You Can Dance. And that's out there. And so I think something I said, I was thinking to myself, well, what is accessible? And I was like, so many people are on YouTube, so many people are on Instagram. Now, you know, TikTok has become crazy now during this pandemic and stuff. I mean, I'm not on TikTok, but and so I just thought digitalizing work for me was just like, oh, well, this is a way that is for the most part free, providing they already have the phone and the access to the internet. And is a way of them just intentionally or unintentionally consuming some of contemporary dance, and therefore hopefully broadening their horizon. So if there is that one child who loves dancing and moving about in their space, but just thinks it's something that they do, and they're like, oh, actually, I could make a career out of this. You know, they can see people who are working in the industry, teaching at well-known schools and also attending these well-known schools and also creating their own work. You see them in gallery spaces, in theatre, on screen. It's just becomes slightly more normalized and less of a, you dance, well, what do you do for a normal job, you know?
Let's talk about one of your pieces that is out there right now. You've done the movement direction to a song called Young King, which is also a music video, and it came out in August this year. But the words, which are performed by Jess Malley, were actually written in 2018 as a response to police brutality against Black men up until that point. I've heard her say that she hopes it has something prophetic to say about a young king's future, and that it is a song of hope. And obviously right now is a very salient time to release it in 2020 with the international outcry at the murder of George Floyd. Could you tell me a bit about your involvement in the project, and if you're comfortable about your reaction to the material?
Yeah, definitely. So actually there's a young videographer director called Edim. Yeah, who I've known through mutual friends for a little while. Like, we went to the same church for a bit and so on. And then, and I've always kind of seen some stuff that he's put online. And he reached out to me and was like, hey, I'm directing this video called Young King, and we're creating a visual to go alongside and marry with the words and the song and the music that Jess Malley and the whole team have created. And he told me, he sent me the treatment, and he kind of showed me how the journey through and which elements he would like me to kind of be involved in. And he wanted to, because he was talking about, you know, the Black male image. And sometimes when people see the Black male image, they don't typically associate it with a Black male classical or contemporary dancer. And so he wanted to, I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but, you know, this inclusion of something that is not too stereotypical but in a very positive light to help reframe the narrative surrounding black men was something that I think was quite central in Young King. So we have images of the family man, of young, carefree kids running around and having a great time and working together. And then you can see the technical ability of Nahum McLean, again, a very good friend of mine and really amazing dancer who also danced with me at Alston. Mm-hmm. And it was just finding a movement vocabulary that showcased Nahum in his technical light, and also without it being too much of my voice, with it being kind of a marriage of my voice, Edom's voice, and Nahum's voice collectively to create this movement so that it's got the right synergy to flow with the rest of the visual.
It's a really beautiful video. I found it really moving. I would really congratulate everyone involved.
Oh, thank you.
A poem dedicated to my newfound nephews and my brothers, and my friends' sons whose skin shimmers golden in the sun, and all the uncles, friends, and all our fathers, and all the ones who didn't make it. We love you, we honor you, and we see you. Young King, I see you.
I mean, a music video is quite a specialized process anyway, because you might have one day outside, you know, weather allowing, and you're kind of waiting for a lot of technical things like cameras and sound to be put in place. And then you have to kind of just deliver. But if I put you in a studio and I said, okay, here are two dancers. And I said, let's see what kind of 5-minute piece we have at the end of it. How would you start? Do you tend to like throw a bunch of material down like a lump of clay and then start forming it? Or do you tend to work more in layers? Like, what would be your natural?
I think I'm definitely someone who likes to work in layers. Typically, actually, I ask a lot of questions before I go into something. So I'm just like, you know, is there a theme? Is there a specific topic? Or, you know, again, the length? Or what type of sound? Am I allowed to use any sound? And this type of stuff. Because I find that music, similar to Richard, actually, really influences me, because I'm super influenced by sound and music and rhythm living in the body. I think I would typically like to have pre-prepared some, like a bank of movement, which doesn't have to be set, but it's kind of starting off. It's a starting point of building a movement language with whoever I'm in the room with. I then, if the dancers are open to, would try to set a task just so I can get to know the dancers physically a little bit more and what their voice might look like physically. And then I think from there, kind of build a language together. Mm-hmm. I really don't like to impose my voice too much onto other artists. I feel like even though I'm choreographing or might give majority of the steps, there will probably still be like a small portion where it's the dancer's voice that's been married with hopefully my voice physically within the piece. And then we'd create that way, I think.
So do you use your own body as one of the layers when you're making?
Yeah, I do actually. And I think recently, and this, when I say recently, this was honestly like 2 days ago, I had recorded myself improvising, and I was teaching this material that I'd created after improvising to someone else. And I was like, oh, actually, in some ways, I do have quite a unique way of moving, which I didn't really recognize before in myself. And so I think sometimes it allows me to access different grooves and melodies within my body and rhythms. That if I'm just thinking 5, 6, 7, 8, I don't typically access. So I like using my body as a layer to see what's out there. But then the same process that I have on myself, I tend to try and offer to whoever I'm in the room with as well. So that, I don't know, just it's a fusion of voices. I'm not too big of a fan of imposing 100% of the piece onto people that I'm working with. I like a bit more of a collaborative or an exchange, so that the dancers feel they can give something that they're comfortable with, and then, you know, and we can go from there.
I'm going to speak about someone else who I've done an interview with, who's a Bharatanatyam dancer named Sita Patel. She's also a choreographer. And she says, actually, I spoke to her 2 days out. Her interview was 2 days after George Floyd was murdered.
Wow.
And I asked her you know, as artists, do we have a mandate to respond to world events in our work? Should we be representing these things and our opinions on world events? And she very rightfully said she can't speak for all artists, but that she felt she had to. Mm-hmm. Because she said, and this is, sorry, what I was trying to get to, is as she says, you don't see work by people who look like me on stages in Britain. As soon as I put a piece on stage, as soon as I walk on stage, it is inherently political.
Yeah.
And I wondered what your response is to that feeling. Do you feel that as well? You're speaking about really feeling this drive to push forwards with opening up these silenced voices in your work.
Yeah.
Do you feel that makes your work inherently political?
Yeah, I think, and again, similar to what Sita said, I do have to only speak for myself in this moment because I know people have varying degrees of opinions on it. I don't think anyone has to do anything. Like, I don't think because you're a person of color, you have to respond to potentially politically charged topics. I sometimes feel like I have a duty to, and sometimes I feel like it's too much of an emotional burden. And I do wish to present an alternative image to show that this is not my entire existence. So whilst I do experience racism and sexism and goodness knows whatever else on a daily basis, that doesn't define who I am. That's just, it is part of my lived experience. It's part of my being, but I've chosen to not allow that to define who I am. I do think where I have to agree with Sita, I think, but I'll frame it this way. When I put my piece Token on stage at Resolution, and, you know, it had three dancers of colour, and you heard our experiences on stage speaking about what it felt like to be from a different country or from a different ethnic background and living in the UK. You heard about it on stage, we danced it out, and so it was quite raw. I was thinking that because the piece was created by a Black woman myself, the lens through which people saw my piece would naturally be different to if I was not Black or female and putting this piece on stage. So the very nature of my existence as a Black woman in Western society has become politicized because of how unequal our rights are moving around on a day to day. So me wearing my natural hair on stage, some can view as a political statement because the afro is associated with a political movement, when in reality, this is just how my hair grows. But the lens through which people see it is politicized because of the current social climate that we're in. And so I think I am very aware at the lens through which I believe my work can be viewed. I think as a Black woman, in times I feel, and again, just personal opinion, that my work is critiqued to a higher level because there's more expectation placed on me and it's being judged to a higher level because there are other social themes running through my existence as a Black female. So naturally that then gets poured onto my work. And so when I then do choose to talk about something that is politically charged, that lens becomes even more critical, I think. Is what I'd say. I think it's how the work is viewed because of how I am viewed as a person in society.
Well, I mean, people have obviously believed in you from you telling me about your journey as a 6-year-old in your PE class doing your your spring points.
My spring points and skips. I was having the best time.
And well, that's what it should be like. My goodness. It sounds like some really like holistic mentorship you had through that and through school and into Rombert. And now with Matthew Bourne's new adventures. So they've started a new project during the pandemic called Adventures in Film. It's a way of financially supporting and guiding three upcoming choreographers. And the outcome of the project is going to be three short dance films. And you were chosen as one of the three. With a simple brief for each choreographer, that it needs to be a story that is generally told with movement and that the choreographer has basically complete control. So you create the concept, the storyboard, the costumes, casting, location, and right down to directing the film. Yes. So you basically have carte blanche. and so much control. So I wondered, if someone put that all on the table, which of those elements did you pick up first when you wanted to start the piece?
Which did I pick up first? I'm quite a visual person, and like I said, with music as well. So I started listening to music. Well, the beginning of it, I had the title, for some reason, I was just daydreaming, because I do this quite a lot. And I was thinking about what I would like to say on the film. And again, funnily enough, following on from our previous conversation, I was thinking, all right, I've been given a platform where my artistic voice can be heard. What am I choosing to give time to? Mm-hmm. And with having thought about, you know, having so many things speaking about the Black experience, and so many things also talking about the harsher side of the Black experience here in the UK in particular, I just thought that I wanted to kind of present something that was just something about the individuals, so that we're not being seen as Black individuals first. You're just seeing art on stage, or you're seeing a film and you're seeing dancers move, and you see that before you see that we're Black and it was created by someone who's Black. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I just had an image of a chessboard and the title Checkmate, which is the title of my film. And that's all I had for about 2 weeks. And then the day before I had to, because what we had to do is pitch the idea and concept to the Adventures in Film, New Adventures, and T Films, the production company as well. And so I just started listening to music. And as I listened to music, the idea kind of came from there, really. So it was music's something that I tend to pick up first.
With a name like Checkmate, that sounds adversarial to me, like a contest or pitching two minds against each other. Can you tell me if that's incorporated any of the movement with Issan Debania and Rhys Dennis, who are the dancers in the piece?
Yeah, it is a little bit. I think what you see is two parallel individuals. One that we get to see a little bit more of, and we get to know a little bit more at the beginning of the film, and one that kind of exists in a more sporadic way throughout the film, in a bit more of in an anonymous fashion. And my question to myself was just like, oh, can you put yourself in Checkmate? Like, how would that happen? You know, where you have to like force yourself to confront something. And I didn't want it to be too specific. And so you see kind of parallels between Issan and Rhys moving through the film. We're introduced to Rhys as a character first. Again, not too much is given away about him, but we get to see his face, we get to see him moving, you get to see him in a home-like space, and then you just get hints of a shadow figure, i.e. Issan, kind of present and peering from distant spaces in the background, upstairs, downstairs. And then there's a point in the film where Rhys transitions from his normal space into an unknown space, and the journey kind of goes with the two of them side by side from there on through to the end.
So was there a piece that changed everything for you, Monique?
I think I've actually already mentioned this piece. It has to be Alvin Ailey's Revelations. It honestly has to be. And it's such a cliched answer as a young Black woman in contemporary dance. Mm-hmm. However, it is the most truthful one. When I first read that question and I thought about it, that was the first piece, because it honestly changed my entire outlook on contemporary dance. And that was the first time that I realized that I could be a technical dancer in myself, and truly believes it. And I decided that I wanted to dance in Sadler's Wells.
There's basically no other answer you can give then. And was there a piece that you maybe didn't love, but you think has value? And I often just frame this for interviewees. So it could be a guilty pleasure. It could be a movie that you saw and you walked out and you're like, oh my God, I hated that. But then a month later, you're still thinking about it. It could be a working experience that was difficult, but nourishing. There's no one answer to this question.
I don't know. I honestly really struggled with this. I have a piece that I feel like might make people uncomfortable when they watch it. And it is a dance piece, but I think is really important for people to see, which is by Joseph Tunga for Just Us Dance Theatre. Mm-hmm. He has a piece called Born to Manifest, which also very similarly is talking about the Black male experience. And it's talking about it in a very raw and vulnerable way. And even at some points, like, you will feel uncomfortable in the audience, but it's because you have to like confront the reality of of people's experiences.
There was just like one point in the piece where they started making what felt like monkey noises and stuff.
It's a racist trope.
Yeah, absolutely. And seeing them do that on stage, I immediately felt so uncomfortable, but also it was uncomfortable at the like rawness of the reality of knowing that this is something that actually does happen, you know?
Would you like to nominate an artist for us to check out who we might not know about yet?
Again, it's also a bit unfair because I've already mentioned him because he's in my film. But Rhys Dennis, and, well, can I be cheeky? I'm going to nominate two. Rhys and Wada, they have a company called Fubu Nation. And the two of them, they perform with such a synergy that I just feel like more people need to see their work because it's so beautiful to see two people so in sync taking such risks and creating their own work, and also feels like to me that they create very authentic work that's true to them as well. And they're making some excellent work. They've got some digital content, Ruins, I think, is a duet that is being filmed and being showcased online and stuff like that. And I just feel like I would love more people to see their work because their company, in my opinion, is doing some really excellent stuff.
Fubu Nation's website is fubunation.org. We'll link to it in the show notes, along with Jonah Dance Company's website and their Instagram, which is Jonah_dance_company. Make sure you also check out Monique's piece for Adventures in Film. You can see it across all the new Adventures channels. We'll make sure to add a link to that as well. Okay, closing credits. This season of Movers, Shakers, Makers is supported by the Norfolk Arts Project Fund and using public funding by the National Lottery through the Arts Council England. It has also been a Makeshift Company production. Follow us on Instagram at Makeshift Company and check out our website, makeshiftcompany.com, where there is a link to the podcast website for show notes. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you rate and review the show, it would be most appreciated. Thanks for listening. And now, from the cutting room floor, I give you...
Call Adventures in Film.
Yes.
Aha, see, someone else says film. Haha.
Yes.
Adventures in Digitization.
Could you imagine?